leader Yunus Bekyevkurov last year. Russia's North Caucasus region has been plagued by near-daily attacks on police and officials. Many analysts describe the violence there as a civil war between the Kremlin-backed administrations of the region and Islamist insurgents. Oppositionists say the insurgency is a result of Moscow's clampdown on dissent in the region. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
A new report finds foreclosure activity in the U.S. leveling off further last month. A private research firm, Realty Track, says the number of homes caught up in some stage of the foreclosure process declined 3% last month. Analysts say banks are filing fewer new foreclosures as they work through the backlog that has accumulated over the past year and a half. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count special report addresses the importance of reading by the end of third grade at aecf.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We expect that juries will represent their communities, but all too often, they do not. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about a recent study by the Equal Justice Initiative. This is a private, nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to indigent defendants and also to prisoners who've been denied fair and just treatment in the legal system. It's based in Montgomery, Alabama. And they have put out a report that was the result of taking a close look at jury selection in several states, in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee. And they report that they uncovered serious evidence of racial discrimination in jury selection in every one of those states, particularly when it comes to serious criminal trials and death penalty cases. In this hour of the show, we'll take a look at the problem of racial discrimination in jury selection. And our guest for the program is Kathleen Price. She is a cooperating senior attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative. She's former law clerk of Justice Fred Banks on the Mississippi Supreme Court. She is a 1999 National Association for Public Interest Law Equal Justice Fellow and has coordinated complex litigation at the Equal Justice Initiative for several years. She is joining us this morning by telephone as we talk, of course. Questions are welcome from people listening. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it's a long-distance call, you may use that. That's 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And, of course, if you're interested in finding out more about the Equal Justice Initiative, or if you'd like to read the report, which we're talking about here this morning, you can go to their website, which is www.eji.org. Ms. Price, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
I'm very honored to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. I just would start with a few lines here that form a kind of a preface to the report. It comes right before the executive summary, and these were lines, I believe, that were penned by your executive director. He writes that today in America, there's perhaps no arena of public life or governmental administration where racial discrimination is more widespread, apparent, and seemingly tolerated than in the selection of juries. Nearly 135 years after Congress enacted the 1875 Civil Rights Act to eliminate racially discriminatory jury selection, the practice continues, especially in serious criminal and capital cases. That's a pretty stark and stunning kind of thing to say.
It is, but I think it's really quite apt. The truth is that in so many arenas in our public life, as well as our private life, the way that we think about racism has really come a long way. People do not tolerate kind of the naked, blatant racism in the administration of many government functions. you know, they tolerate it much less than was true, say, 50, 75 years ago. But what we've observed as lawyers in the context of the criminal justice system is that what happens at the selection of juries really is kind of just, it's just kind of, it's widespread and we're kind of blind to it. And so part of the purpose of our report and bringing this to public light is we want to educate people about what's happening in our names and that sort of on behalf of the people of the states and the jurisdictions in the context of juries.
And you're one of the things that this report concludes is that the officers of the court, judges, prosecutors, people who are associated with the process are well aware that this is the case.
Right. We think that's correct. The way the law works, it's kind of a very technical process to uncover it and to remedy it. Mm-hmm. But we do, part of what we're trying to push with this report is this observation that courts are really reluctant to kind of reach in and do their duty in terms of protecting jurors from this sort of discrimination and, quite frankly, protecting the fairness of the proceedings, the criminal proceedings.
And I mentioned that this report looks very specifically at jury selection in these states. I think there are eight. Do I have that right?
Yes.
The ones that I named. Do you think that if one did a similar kind of study looking at other states around the country, do you think that you would find something similar?
Well, yes. I say this with reservation. Okay, part of the reason that we looked at the Deep South states is because can I just back up a little
bit?
You know, you mentioned at the outset that juries are the voice of the people in the criminal justice system, and I think that this is that we need to focus on that. The purpose of the jury is to bring the community voice into a legal determination about a person. They decide what the facts are in any given case. So in a criminal case, the prosecution puts on his version, the defense put on their version. The purpose of the jury really is to sift through what's been put in front of them and make a decision about what they believe has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. In the capital punishment context, in most jurisdictions, juries also make a determination about who deserves to live or die. And so we feel that in sort of the states that have the death penalty, the fairness in the jury selection is even more critical to the fairness of that determination because it's such a fundamental government event to make a decision about who decides to die. So we looked at the Deep South states in part because they feature the death penalty. We also looked at the Deep South states because they are places in America where we have very large populations of people of color. And so I do think, and I say that to say, if we looked in the North, I don't doubt that we would see similar patterns in jury selection and underrepresentation of people of color on juries, but you generally, in much of the North of the United States, you have fewer people of color, generally. So you would probably see less of it because of that. Now, in urban centers in the North, we absolutely have seen this. So in places like Philadelphia, there's been just a big historical problem. Places like Chicago, places where there are concentrations of non-white populations. You see this kind of over and over again since 86, I guess, is when Babson was passed.
Mm-hmm. It seems that there are maybe two levels that we can talk on when you talk about exclusion. And one, I think that the report concentrates mostly on on illegal peremptory strikes, and we'll talk about what that means.
Sure.
And also there's another issue that I'm sure that we'll talk about that I want to get to, and that is whether or not we have adequate participation in the jury pool as a whole, that is, who is called to come down to the courthouse and then who is a potential juror. That's sort of another kind of thing. But
exactly.
It seems that historically that maybe was the greater problem, that is, people weren't even called for a number of reasons, and that there have been attempts to address that. And I think that still, having said that, there are a lot of communities where people would believe, and ours is one of them, that's still a problem. But then we have another kind of level where we have the jury pool, the people are called, they go down to the courthouse, they're selected as potential jurors, but then for reasons which clearly are not allowed, then as the process goes through of impaneling the jury, then the attorneys, and I guess pretty much here we're talking about the prosecutors, find reasons to say, no, I don't want that person.
Exactly. I think that it's it's constructive to sort of think of them as two separate events. Like,
right.
The first is the construction of the jury pool. And I think it's sort of common knowledge that, you know, in 1850, the only people that were qualified for jury service were property-owning white men. And so jury pools consisted of that population, that segment of the population. And over the course of time, the Constitution was interpreted to prohibit the exclusion of different people of color, exclusion of women, just sort of the blanket exclusion of them on the basis of that they were not fit to serve. And so our report does cite, you know, sort of the opening salvo in this was the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which said that you could not exclude black people from the jury pool on the basis of race. And there's been a lot of, you know, we don't have to go through the details of the development of the law around that, but basically by the 1960s, the courts have held that what the Constitution requires is that the jury pool, meaning the large group of people from whom when you get your summons to go to jury duty, the people in that pool has to represent a fair cross-section of the community. So if your county is 75% white, 30% – or not 75% white, 75% white, 20% black, and 5% Asian, then your jury pool really does have to reflect that as a fair cross-section of the community. And then the second layer is sort of – is discrimination that takes place at a later stage. So once people are summoned to jury duty, that's called a venire. So once you've got a group of people who are called into jury duty for a particular case, then the prosecution and the defense make individual decisions about who they want to sit on their jury.
Well, let's talk about that, and then maybe we might go back and talk about the other issue, and that is, how do you get a representative jury pool?
Sure.
I think that people maybe will understand, if they've been through this process, that what happens is that you have this jury pool. So people are called down to the courthouse, and they're kind of sitting there and waiting. So a trial comes along, and they say, we need jurors. They start to draw from the pool, and they bring people in. And the attorneys for both sides, defense and the prosecution, get a chance to ask them some questions and try to figure out who they are, because obviously the two sides want to have a jury that they feel will be favorable to them, either for conviction or for acquittal. So they're asking people questions, and they are able to, for some reasons, to say for a certain number of people, say, Your Honor, to the judge, this person, I don't want this person. They're excused. And so then that person goes. So I guess then the question is, what grounds are allowable or allowed for an attorney to look at a prospective juror and say, thank you very much, but I don't want this person on my jury?
Well, you can legally exclude jurors if it's called for cause. Jurors who cannot be fair to one side or the other are excused from service. They're not. It's from a defendant's standpoint, it's just not fair to be tried in front of a juror that can't be fair and neutral. So, for example, if you have a juror who says, "I can't be fair and neutral. I was the victim of a violent crime." That's a completely legitimate exclusion, and it's not considered a peremptory exclusion. It's considered they're just excused because they're actually not – they can't be fair. Then you have the universe of exclusions that are called peremptory strikes. You strike people for peremptorily. And in that universe, there literally are no limits except for you cannot strike people on the basis of race or gender. You can strike people for any other reason that you don't – like them or want them on your jury, but you cannot strike them on the basis of race or gender.
Mm. And it is your feeling, or is the finding of this report, that significant in the states that you looked at, that there are significant numbers of people who are struck simply for that reason? That they're African American?
Yes, that is our observation. That's our finding. And that particular finding, I think, is probably not controversial. I think in the legal community, it's anecdotal, which doesn't mean it's not science, but it's pretty well known that prosecutors strike people on the basis of their presumptions about them, but also on the basis of race. Proving it is another matter, but the fact that that's kind of how criminal – juries are selected is not so controversial.
Well, given that it might not, say if you were sitting there and you were watching this process and you saw an attorney that it was your feeling that this attorney was striking people because of their race and for no other particular reason, or because of their race or their gender for no other particular reason, and that was just sort of your feeling, and maybe it would seem very obvious, then though the question seemed to be, how would you establish, since that person is not going to tell you that that's what they were doing, how would you establish that was, in fact, what that attorney was doing?
It's a very good question. I appreciate the point that no one's going to say that out loud, because for years and years and years, first of all, it's been illegal to strike people on the basis of race for a long time. But for years, you actually did have to prove, like you had to basically have a quality of evidence that was akin to the prosecutor saying, I struck this person on the basis of race. And believe it or not, sometimes we find that in these cases. But that's not typically the case. Usually what you do is that the court has set up a construct, which is this is sort of generally true in all contexts of racial discrimination. But what you do is you make an argument that there is a kind of a prima facie case of racial discrimination. And so you would point to the prosecutor's pattern of striking. You would point to disparate treatment. So if he struck some African-Americans who seemed to be similarly situated from the community as white people that he permitted to sit or he was okay with, that would give rise to an inference of discrimination. You would look at if the prosecutor has a history of it. So if there have been cases brought against the prosecutor around this, you know, over the years, you can sort of cite that as evidence that, you know, he's been doing it, he's probably doing it here. We have cases where the prosecutors, literally, they'll use all of their peremptory strikes to remove only African Americans. And that does give rise to an inference of discrimination. Then what happens next in the system is that the court usually asks the prosecutor to defend his strike. So he has to articulate reasons for the removal of the people of color from the jury. And that's where it gets complicated, because the law permits him to assert a reason that is sort of technically race neutral on its face. And what we see is prosecutors saying things that are patently untrue. They're pretext for race. They'll say things like, you know, the person lives in a bad neighborhood. That's why I struck them. You know, in most urban centers, this may be harder to determine, but in most counties in America, it's they're pretty sparsely populated. You know what neighborhoods he's talking about. And so that's where you sort of see the pretext for a race-based strike emerges.
And here, again, I guess I want to make sure that I understand and people listening understand that attorneys, they're allowed a certain number of these peremptory challenges. Essentially, they can strike someone, and they don't really, unless the court says, well, why did you strike? They're sort of allowed to a certain number of strikes just because they say, I just don't want that person.
Exactly.
And then it becomes
they're allowed, I just don't want that person, except if the reason they don't want that person is because of race.
But then it sounds like it's difficult. One of the things that you found is in fact that there are some prosecutors who are coached on how to do this without making it look like that's what it is that they're doing. I would imagine if somebody was careful enough and thoughtful enough, they could probably do this in a way. And if they also use some of their strikes, if they really wanted to cover over this, they use some of their strikes to strike, you know, similar white people over time, and so they could point to their record and they could say, but look, here's my record. I'm even-handed on this. If somebody really wanted to, they wanted to put that much effort into it, I would think that it would be possible for them to do that and then make it more difficult for anyone to come along later and say, here we see this pattern of strikes, and we really think that what's going on here, bottom line, is it's all about the race of the potential juror.
Right. I do think, though, that I would say that our more immediate problem is we'd like to see defense lawyers more aggressive in battling these claims. I do think that it's possible to kind of very carefully protect yourself, or prosecutors to very carefully protect themselves about these kinds of strikes. But at the same time, you know, it's not foolproof. And I think you can put on very good arguments for why, you know, it's just not true that this person that you're making all of these allegations about without any support in the record. That's an example of something that defense lawyers could do, is sort of point to the emptiness of the record. Mm-hmm. that, you know, you're saying this person lives in a bad neighborhood, but you didn't ask him any questions about his neighborhood. You're just, you know what I mean? That sort of thing. You're going based on just generic reputation.
And also here, and another one of the points that the report makes is you're feeling that defense attorneys are not doing what they should be doing and in challenging these strikes, right?
Right. Our hope is to really try to help, you know, kind of frankly, both sides of the attorney community become more aware of these kinds of claims and how to protect your clients in this context, as well as protect, you know, protect the sanctity of the jury system.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Kathleen Price. She is a cooperating senior attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative. It is based in Montgomery, Alabama. It's a private nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to people who are indigent and also to prisoners who've been denied fair and just treatment in the legal system. She has coordinated a lot of the complex litigation that has happened there at the Equal Justice Initiative for several years. We're talking about a report that has just been issued by the initiative, taking a look at racial discrimination in jury selection. They argue, based on looking very closely at 8 states in the Deep South, that that is something that is widespread. And if you'd like to read that report, you can go to their website, which would be www.eji, that's their initials, Equal Justice Initiative, EJI.org, and you can read that report. Questions are welcome here on the program as well. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And, of course, you can email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here, someone who is on a cell phone, so we'll go there to our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show. Great topic. I just wanted to share my experience for what it's worth. Actually had a chance, first time ever, to serve on a jury here in Champaign, actually with the U.S. District Court. And it was an interesting experience, the first time for me. And it's a curious thing. The jurors that came in for the juror pool, there was only one black lady that came in and that showed up. And with the being a juror for the U.S. District, you're on call basically the whole month. So the first time she wasn't picked, neither was I. The second time she was, and so was I, and so on and so forth. So the basis of conversations, it was, you know, curious thing is, like, how come there are no blacks represented, you know, proportionally? And her comment to me, and you can take this however you want to, she said, well, the vast majority of people, African-Americans, when they get the request, they simply don't respond to it. And then after the court, after the case, the judge came in and talked to us and kind of closed everything down and said, you know, we get this complaint all the time, and we select proportionally the same amount of whites as blacks, but the blacks don't respond. And I think, I know it's important to spin everything and to, you know, stamp everything with discrimination and racism, but it's really a shame because I think the vast majority of blacks, proportion of the population, do show up as defendants, and it's important that they would be represented by the jury. And I just was wondering, comments by your guest. I'll go ahead and listen up there. Thanks.
Well, this gets us to the sort of maybe to the other part of this, the other thing that I said we really would talk about, I don't want to talk about, and that is, how is it that you get a representative jury pool to start with in the first place before then we get to this other level that we've been talking about of jury selection?
Yeah, I think that's been a source of study for a long time, how you'd build representative pools. What has happened historically is that, well, first of all, the federal jury pools tend to be, they tend to be drawn from larger jurisdictions. And so what's representative in a sort of a federal district might be different than what's representative in a county district, because a federal district would usually encompass several counties. But that said, I do think that different jurisdictions compose their jury pools differently. And I think you're exactly right that how you decide to reach potential jurors drives a lot of who you actually reach. Historically, it used to be dovetailed with things like driver's licenses or voter registration. And you know, recently there's been some investigation into whether there are different ways, different sources you can use to reach more parts of your particular of a particular community. So some of the more I won't say progressive, but places that are trying to just update the way they compose their jury pool are looking at different types of source lists, like people that sign up for utilities and things like that to reach different parts of the population. Because in some parts of the country, not just huge segments of people don't have driver's licenses. They're not registered to vote. And so your pool would necessarily fail to capture them. And that said, I honestly wasn't aware that the I think that many people consider jury duty burdensome, and I definitely appreciate that. But I was not aware that people of color were less likely to show up for jury duty than white people. I thought it was pretty across the board. That's a very interesting point. I mean, I definitely appreciate that.
Though I think that does point to an issue. And it's an issue for all citizens, and that is whether or not people consider serving on a jury an important responsibility so that if they, no matter who they are, so that if they are called, they'll do it. And that it seems like that for in a community, you know, no matter what the makeup is, no matter what you're talking about, you want your juries to be representative of the community. So you also want people when they are called to think, oh, this is an important thing. I should go down there and do that.
Sure, absolutely. And I think, to be honest, I think that sort of the more suburban, the more rural you get, I think the more people value jury service as part of their just part of their civic life. I do think that kind of in urban metropolises, going to jury duty is honestly what people complain about are things like the parking. This is sort of part of what makes it impossible to really be on a jury for a month is that the parking scenario in downtown Philadelphia is just a nightmare. And this is less true. This is less true in much of America. I do think that there are that we certainly could do some work in improving the way people view jury duty and jury service, the importance of it. But I tend to think that's not as much of a problem in huge swaths of America as is commonly thought.
And well, what about the idea that maybe for some people that having to serve, particularly if I'm sure here in a county like ours, I believe the period that you're talking about is just a week. Although if you get involved in a complex trial, it could take longer than that. I don't think, though, at the county level we have that many trials that would go on for just weeks and weeks and weeks.
Right. I think that's right. Most trials are not. They're a few days long. They don't take that long.
But then I would think that there might indeed be some people who for whom being on the jury would in fact be a hardship.
Sure.
That whether they would have family responsibilities, they would have employers that would not be understanding about the importance of letting their employees serve, and that for some people that would really be a problem, and maybe would lead them to either ask to be excused or maybe decide that they simply couldn't turn up.
Right. Not turning up for jury duty doesn't usually what happens is you just get another summons, you know? I do think that the hardship part is something that we need to address. I think, first of all, you can't get fired for doing jury duty, but you don't have to get paid. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, that's very, very hard to support. The tension, though, is that we don't, you know, jurors are paid a nominal amount of money to sort of just cover their expenses and stuff. And the reason that we don't pay jurors more than that is because the whole constitutional right to a jury of your peers means that your jurors are not professional jurors. That's sort of under the king in England, you had professional jurors, people who were paid to sit in judgment. And that one of the things sort of we did with the revolution in the New World was get rid of that on the theory that you need regular people as part of the process whose investment in it is not incentivized by paycheck. But that said, the tension there is that it's financially hard for people. You can generally get excused from jury duty if you're the sole caregiver of children and you just cannot find, you can't find someone to pitch in and help. You know, one of the kind of radical suggestions around that is that courts could provide child care. I mean, there are just a lot of creative ways you could think about making jury duty less burdensome, and I definitely think that jurisdictions are going to have to do that because we're definitely impaneling jurors is a project.
Well, we're just a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, our guest is Kathleen Price. She is a cooperating senior attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. And we're talking about a report that the initiative has just recently released looking at racial discrimination in jury selection, which they conclude, based on a study of 8 southern states, is something that is widespread, particularly when it comes to serious criminal cases and cases that could involve the death penalty. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just for a second, to stay with the question of the representative jury pool, do you, in looking at the states where you did, do you feel that they were doing something truly to address that issue? And in fact, the jury pools were as representative as they should be?
Some were, not all were. We found, for example, in Alabama, they were aggressively trying to investigate alternative ways to reach jurors, like alternative source lists, to get away from just the restriction to voter registrants. Georgia was doing kind of very, very meticulous weighting, so that if they ended up with a pool that was not representative, they made an effort, they sort of made an additional, an extra effort to reach underrepresented communities. And we thought that was actually very progressive, quite frankly. So I do think the states are interested in that problem, and like I said, there are creative ways to resolve it. It can be a bureaucratic quagmire, like changing the rules for composing juries, but that's always a problem that can be solved.
Mm-hmm. Well, if going back to the question that we started out with, or Matt, we started out with, was that then once you get your jury pool, how juries are selected. Just how, and the problem that you really identified was illegal strikes, that is, strikes where you really suspect that the attorney is saying, I don't want this person, and the reason they're saying that I want this person is largely because of their race and for no other reason, which is the one thing, race and gender, are the things that you can't strike for those reasons. Just how, forgive me for sort of asking it this way, but just how bad is it? What are some of the worst examples that you found?
I think I appreciate the question. I think some of the most disappointing answers that we found were prosecutors claiming that they didn't want people of color on their juries because this person had low intelligence, that person was illiterate, this person, we had one instance which is cited in the report, where the prosecutor literally said in open court that the reason that he struck this woman was because she shucked and jived on her way into the courtroom. And if that's not just kind of a pretext for racist, I'm not sure what is. Those are some of the worst examples. We have cases in which prosecutors will make allegations about jurors that are impossible to really disprove on the spot. So, for example, I had a case in which a prosecutor who was notorious for striking people for race, he would accuse potential jurors in my case of having a criminal record, of having one man, he said he had a bad reputation in the community. And it's hard to respond to that on the spot except by calling the jury and putting them on the stand and asking them, kind of candidly under oath, do you have a bad reputation in the community? Mm-hmm. But the prosecutor was able to get away with that because the court credited it. And we appealed that. And, for a lot of reasons, we weren't able to get relief. But definitely the court expressed reservation and skepticism about those, purported race-neutral reasons. But probably what is generally true about, kind of the worst cases is that they're vague accusations about people that are hard to discredit on the spot, or they reflect, a hunch about somebody that isn't really rooted in anything they said, anything they did. Another example of that would be the instance cited in the report about the guy said he just couldn't build a rapport with the potential juror. I mean, jury selection is, you're in the courtroom, there are 14 of you, the prosecutor's asking questions, and he's concluded that he can't build a rapport with you because maybe you didn't raise your hand for any of the questions. I mean, that's That's kind of hunch-like. It's akin to saying the prosecutor just didn't like him. And we think these are probably the worst cases of, or the worst places in which, you know, racism can just be invidious and trenchant and operative, but it's hard to reach.
And it is your finding that when you look at the at what is at stake in these cases, that is what are the charges against the defendant, that the more serious the charge when we're talking about the possibility of the death penalty, or it's a very serious crime, that you find this kind of exclusion to be more serious, the more serious the crime is, as opposed to lower order things that you might imagine would come to trial?
I would say the consequences are more serious in more serious cases, but I'm not sure I would say the instance of it is more common. I actually think it's pretty common generally. I think it's pretty common generally certainly in criminal cases. I just think the consequences of having juries that are not representative in sort of more serious cases are different. You know, we have to remember that, what the juries do in criminal cases is they make the determination about the facts. And most people the evidence against them is usually about eyewitness testimony. It's about one person says this, another person says that. Sometimes you have, you know, kind of really strong forensic evidence in cases, but that's actually not as common as you would be led to believe by, say, Law and Order. It's much more common to be in prison because of eyewitness testimony or because of, quite frankly, police testimony about something you said or did. And this is especially true in the context of drug crimes, which, you know, our prisons are filled with people who have been convicted of some quality of a drug crime, usually a possession drug crime. And so some of what happens when you don't have representative juries is that a version of the case becomes more credible than another version of the case.
And if on appeal, how likely is it, or how possible is it, that you could make the argument that that was a problem, and that what happened was in this conviction was essentially a result of what happened in the process of jury selection? And is that something that courts are going to consider on appeal?
Well, courts definitely consider it. You don't have to appeal that the conviction wouldn't have happened because of jury selection. What you're appealing is the fairness of the proceeding. Mm-hmm. We should not be putting people in prison, and certainly not putting people to death, pursuant to a system that excludes people on the basis of race from the jury. That's just not fair. It's not just. It's not constitutional, and we shouldn't tolerate it as a society that's kind of committed to due process and the rule of law. That's what you're appealing. So even if a person would have been convicted by a fairly composed jury, it is not a just conviction unless the process was fair. And that's, I think, very important for people to keep in mind as they think about this issue. It's not that black jurors see facts differently than white jurors. It's that a system is not fair if people have been excluded from jury service on the basis of race or gender.
We have some other. Oh, pardon me for interrupting you. I was just going to you finish your thought, and I was going to say we have some other callers here.
Oh, well, I would just say the one more thing. I think the other layer to this is that the experience of the actual potential juror. Mm-hmm. It is humiliating to go into any government agency and be treated differently because of your race or your gender, and that's another part of the system. That's another victim in this process, is that people get called to jury service, they show up, and then they're sent home because they're told they're not fit to serve.
And I suppose that might indeed make one inclined not to show up the next time that you were called, if in fact you were ever called again.
Well, it's certainly discouraging. It's certainly discouraging.
We're moving into about our last 10 minutes in this part of Focus. Our guest is Kathleen Price. She is a senior cooperating senior attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. It's a private nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to indigent defendants and also to prisoners who've been denied fair and just treatment in the legal system. We're talking about a report that they've just recently put out looking at racial discrimination in jury selection. And again, if you'd like to read the report, you can go to their website, which is www.eji.org, and you can do that. And we have a couple of callers here. We'll go to Belgium next. Line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Morning.
I've been on jury duty many, many, many times, different types of juries. And I've gotten to the point where I refuse to do it anymore. And the reason being, number one, there are many, many biases in the system. The racial one is just one of them. I've noticed that when you're in the jury room, one individual controls the entire verdict a lot of times. One strong individual can sway whether the person is guilty or innocent. I mean, and not necessarily because of the facts, but because of the way they point out things and stuff, and they emphasize one thing, de-emphasize other things. And it's really, really not very just when you get right down to it. It's just how people feel at that time. And I've, in being selected for a juror many times, I say I cannot be fair and impartial because of these facts that I've just pointed out to you. I see that there's so many inconsistencies in it. So the judge then makes me sit in the back of the courtroom and follow the entire proceedings. I have to sit there and through all the court situation, and when I get up, I get to be dismissed because the judge doesn't like the fact that I say I cannot be fair and impartial for either side. Now, that's totally disrupts the system, doesn't it?
You know, it's interesting. I'm hearing a lot in what you're saying. At the outset, the notion, I mean, I think that the fact that you've been summoned for jury service so many times reflects the problem with the jury pool. That's clearly too small of a pool. And this is something that I've observed. There are people that never, ever get called to jury duty, like me, and there are people who get called over and over and over again. And it's insane. And I think it's really a function of too small of a pool that makes random selection flow this way.
Well, you have to realize that I live in a rural community, okay? And so we're not in a city where there's just unending population to draw from. Also, the aspect is I vote, you know, and so therefore for many years being a voter was the reason why you got called. And now they kind of do it with your driver's license a little bit somehow, and I don't know quite how that works. The selection aspect of it is improper when it comes to really getting a true and honest jury pool to be honest about the trial.
Sure. You know, Justice Marshall, Thurgood Marshall, opined in a couple of opinions that he felt, just as what you said, that there really are a lot of biases that are operative in a courtroom, and that in jury selection what you're hoping to do is balance them. So if you have people with biases in one direction, so for example, if you have just whatever, people whose experience would lead them to be sort of inclined to see things one way, then you definitely also want people on jury whose experiences might incline them to see things the other way. And I guess I wonder if your concept, if the notion that each individual juror has to be kind of neutral is just not something we can, just not a target we can meet.
Exactly, and that's why I try to explain that to the court, and they don't want to hear that.
Do you think it was possible in the context of your deliberations to have to sort of force a dialogue, I think the theory is that what's going on back there is kind of robust debate. I've been always wanting to be on a jury. I'd love to be on a jury,
but
I'm sure I'd never get picked.
But I
guess I'm curious, as someone who's experienced it several times, do you think that it is, what do you think the court could do or the system could do to facilitate better dialogue? So I hear what you're saying about one person dominating. I think I've interviewed hundreds of jurors, and I hear that a lot, that sort of one strong personality or one, you know, a person that knows a lot about guns or something just really does dominate the conversation. But would you think the system could do anything to facilitate better, more effective deliberations?
Well, yes, I do. I think there's a much better way, and that's to get, when you say a jury of your peers, it's not necessarily wise, because my peers may not be intelligent enough to make a good decision. That's what I'm getting at. Maybe you do need something like you do in England or wherever else you said, a professional jurors. You know what I'm saying? Where you have a group of people who are more than willing to do the job, they get paid appropriately, and they see the facts in a very clear and open way. They're not biased, and they're intelligent enough not to be biased.
Well, if you were a defendant facing criminal charges, would you be as comfortable with jurors that were getting paid by the government?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would, especially when I look at some of the, having gone into many, many jury pools, and I don't want to be negative about my peers, but some of them I don't want making decisions on me. You know what I mean? They can't make decisions for themselves, let alone make decisions on something that might be important in somebody else's life.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I'm coming down to the point here. We have about 5 minutes left, and I have another person I want to get to. I don't know if Ms. Bryce, you want to offer any last thought on what the caller had to say.
Well, I appreciate the insights. I mean, I think we've had a lot of problems in jurors. We're here today talking about racial discrimination, but I appreciate that it's a very, very troubled system.
Right. All right. Let's go to Champaign for someone here. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I've been called for jury duty just exactly once, and was, you know, watching for to see how the things would fare racially. And I was pleased to see. I know that's not always the case in this area that the jury pool is approximately at parity. But in my case, it was. There were about a tenth or so of the people looked black to me. I was in voir dire for one jury, and that was the interesting part because, the suggestion is that, you know, if the goal is to have a jury that represents the population, but there's a subpopulation, the black subpopulation here, who have much more frequent interactions with, for whatever reason, whether for discrimination or whatever, have much more frequent interactions with the police, they get excluded from the jury specifically for that reason. So among the questions that were asked were, you know, have you had past interactions with the state's attorney's office? Have you been charged with anything? And some of the white people on the jury were, you know, friends or friends of friends with people in the state's attorney's office or worked with the police or something like that, and they were dismissed because of that. But four black people were called up, and each of them had some criminal justice had been charged or otherwise investigated or something by people in the state's attorney's office, and they were removed from the jury because of that. So the pattern I see is this kind of thing can be self-sustaining even if in the jury selection process, the prosecutors don't even need to discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
The jury pool can be unrepresentative just because of this. Okay, anyway, I wonder if you have any suggestions of anything that could be done. It seems as though in order to compensate for this, the jury pool would have to be biased the other way and have more of the more of the black population representative in the people who were showing up in the jury pool.
Well, it's interesting. I think that there are some jurisdictions that have taken a different approach to this. You could require prosecutors to probe a little further into the impact of a particular potential juror's experience with law enforcement or, you know, just even on the other side. I mean, you know, if you get potential jurors who have been – they're close to people who've been victims of violent crime, then you want to sort of talk to them about what that experience has been like and how they process it and whether, the bottom line is – where does this leave you today in terms of being able to be fair about what you hear in this case? There are jurisdictions that require prosecutors because it's sort of the same situation where the black population has a higher involvement with law enforcement for, as you said, for whatever reason. That's not the subject of that, you know, the jury selection conversation. But they require prosecutors to probe further into whether or not – into how this person feels about, for example, the police. If you have a case in which there's going to be testimony from police officers, you don't – you know, as a prosecutor, you wouldn't want jurors who were automatically going to disregard that or automatically think the police were bad guys, just as you wouldn't want – well, I guess a prosecutor would want people who automatically think that the police are necessarily good guys. They always tell the truth. That's not fair either. I mean, it's a different kind of bias. But so what some jurisdictions do is they really do require more aggressive probing into whether or not you can be fair. Because when you ask people to reflect on that, you can usually overcome a lot of what you think might be operative. You know, people will reveal themselves to be, you know, maybe traumatized by an experience. Or they may reveal themselves to not have been traumatized at all. They actually, it just was a mistake, and they really do see it that way.
Would it be, do you think it could be appropriate to have people impaneled on a jury who'd had interactions with the same police officers who were involved in a case?
I think it depends. The same, I guess you're saying in like sort of very, very small community. You can't avoid it in some communities, like, you know, counties where there's a sheriff's office, and it's been the same sheriff for the last 35 years. And so it's not, you can't really avoid that. So I think in scenarios like that, you wouldn't have, I don't think it necessarily would be fair to exclude people, but you would want to probe a little bit. You should be able to have the opportunity as counsel to really probe the potential juror for where, what happened, what the prejudices are, what's going on with the interaction. I mean, the flip side is you have, you know, this is just a concept, but the idea that you have a trial not just by a jury of your peers, but by a jury of people who know all the actors in a case. I mean, in a very small community, that's not necessarily unfair either.
Very good.
All right. Just as one final question, we're very short on time here, is we've clearly, for the person who's on trial, this could make a tremendous difference in what the outcome of the trial was. For someone who, though, was willing to serve, wanted to serve, and was excluded for this reason, we've talked about how that, you know, could affect the way you would feel about the justice system. Is there any remedy? Do people ever pursue that if they feel that they've been discriminated against as a potential juror?
Well, we've brought class actions on behalf of excluded communities. And again, the remedy there isn't to bankrupt jurisdictions. The remedy there is to really get them to change their policies. And we've actually had some real successes there. I have not encountered an individual juror who thought there was anywhere they could go with feeling discriminated. And so I think a lot of people don't realize. They realize it doesn't feel good. And as I said, it's humiliating to be sent home in what feels like a race-based determination about your fitness to serve as a juror. But most people go on with their life. I mean, they don't feel like this is something that they can sue about. It's, you know, you're called to jury duty about someone else's legal problem, largely.
Well, we're at the point here where we're going to have to stop it, because we hear it simply at the end of the time. I do want to say, again, for people who are interested in reading some more about this, you could read the report that we have talked about on racial discrimination and jury selection. It was something that was done by the Equal Justice Initiative, and you can go to their website, which is www.eji.org, and read that report. Also finds out some other things about them. Our guest this morning, Kathleen Price, is a cooperating senior attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative. And Ms. Price, we want to say to you, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was an honor.
We're about midway through the program. We'll have more in the next part of Focus. We'll be talking about contemporary politics in Egypt.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
In the next hour, as I said, some conversation about Egyptian politics. First, though, we're going to take a break so we can bring you an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. Let's go right on out to the pits in Kansas City. July wheat at 460 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. December 490, up 2 and a quarter. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 431 and a half, up 3 and a half. December 479, up 4. July corn, 341 and a quarter, up 3. September, 351 and a half, up 4 and a half. December, 360, up 1 and a half. Go out to March of 2011, bigger gains there, 377 and a quarter, up 5 and a quarter. July soybeans, 931, down 12 and a half. They had been as high as 951 today. August, 920, down a half. September, 898 and a half, down 4 and 3 quarters. November, 891 and a half. They are down 5. July soybean meal, $281.90, down $3.60. July soybean oil, $36.76, up a penny. June live cattle, $90.10, up 45. August feeders, $109.70, up 47.5. June lean hogs are flat. They're at 77.45. Looking at meteorologist Drew Lenner's weather highlights, he says that weekend high temperatures will reach into the 80s and lower 90s with very high humidity. Isolated to scattered showers and thunderstorms will occur daily through the weekend. Rain frequency, coverage, and amounts will be the greatest Saturday and Sunday as cool front drifts into the region. Temporarily cooling and lower humidity is likely late this weekend and then early into next week. Returning warm and humid conditions will occur Monday night into Tuesday, bringing back the steamiest environment and returning the risk of isolated showers. Aggressive crop development is likely during this time period. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. It's 1101 Central Time.